For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Telling you, bro. What's been happening, bro?
Not too much.
Still hitting the Morpeggios?
Hi, my name is Shane Terrio, and you are listening to The Riff Raff. Music, stories, and insights from the front line. Riff Raff. My guest today is Mr. George Porter Jr. George is best known as the bass player for one of the funkiest bands in the world, The Meters. Coming out of New Orleans, along with Zigaboo Modalist on drums, Art Neville on keys, Leo Nocentelli on guitar, they set the bar way, way high back in the late 60s. They've influenced countless bands. Sir Paul McCartney himself has even been quoted as saying that George was his favorite bass player. I first met George at Art Neville's house years ago, and we've done a fair amount together since then. It's always fun to work with him. We were in the studio today working on a record together, and I asked him if he would do this interview, and he said, hey, let's do it tonight. So I'm going to pick his brain a bit and see if I can dissect some of the funk. In this interview, you'll understand what makes his playing so infectious. His sense of space and his sense of groove is huge. So step inside this dimly lit back room of the beautiful Parlor Recording Studios in the Irish Channel section of New Orleans. It's around 7:30 p.m. Man, the room smells like amplifier tubes, like that old funky Ampeg flip-top bass amp he's plugged into. Hope you
one,
enjoy.
Check a one, two, check a one.
Sitting here with George Porter Jr. Thanks for doing this, George.
Oh, my pleasure, man. Thank you.
I know it was a long day. We were in the studio today, but...
what do you want to know that isn't
story,
written already?
You know, crazy. I want to know some good shit. I want to know about driving the RV on the beach. See, I know some shit. See, you forget, man. I know all of them other cats, too. You know, Art and... As many people as I run into bass players outside of New Orleans, like really well-known people, man, they always mention, of course, the Meters, but specifically your bass parts constantly come up, man. Just the simplicity, but the groove and just the badassery of the stuff you've done, you know. So I guess we could just talk about that. Like, things I always wanted to know, and I've played with you guys a little bit here and there, is like when you did those records, man, like, you know, for people listening, Rejuvenation, countless musicians, man, that record, they cite that as being like a game changer, you know, when they heard Rejuvenation, not just Zig stuff, but your bass parts too. I mean, the whole deal worked together. I mean, how long did it take to do that record, or how long, let me rephrase it, like to do a track?
Well, you know, it had to, you know, it kind of took a little while because halfway through the record, we got, I think it was Robert Palmer came in to do the Sneak and Sally project. So we kind of got sidelined with Robert's project. And then you know, that might have took a couple of weeks before we got back. We were able to get back in the studio. And then I want to say something else came up. Another project came up that Alan was doing. And we ended up being sidelined again. You know,
so
it might have took 2.5 months to get that record, you know, 2 months to get all the tracks done. And then, you know, Leo and Zig kind of endlessly went in there every minute that Kaz or Roberta was available and the studio wasn't working to work on the project to get it, you know, to do the finishing, to add the horns and stuff like
now,
that.
Now, by Kaz, you mean Cosmo?
Cosmo Tassi.
Cosmo Tassi, yeah. Legendary New Orleans engineer, producer, mm-hmm. Yeah. Did you do, was that record at C-Saint?
Well, it wasn't as much, wait, I'm saying that, I say that wrong, but it wasn't as much Cos as it was, by that time it was Skip Goblin was now the house engineer.
I see. Yeah, because those sounds, man, they're just, that's the stuff we were trying to recreate today, this record we were doing today together. You know, people want to come in and get that sound, you know. And, you know, like something like, I'm trying to think, man, there's so many signature bass parts. Of course, we got to talk about Sissy Strut. You know, I was talking to John Schofield about this a few months ago because I interviewed him for the podcast. And he did Sissy Strut on one of his records back, you know, in the 80s. And I said, man, you know what? One thing, everybody always plays it wrong, you know? And he's like, well, how do you play it? And I said, it's like, right?
Yeah.
But everybody goes,
right.
And then
right,
you,
right.
As soon as you heard it, you're like, no, it's not right. It's not the right part.
No, that is right. Yeah,
right.
Right? Everybody plays it wrong.
Everybody
yeah.
plays it wrong. Let's play it. Let's play it. 3, 4.
Oh. 3, 4. That's wrong there,
yeah.
Hold it, that's stop it.
Okay.
It's the lick is.
Show it to me. Not da da da. See, okay, all right. See, man, my shit is so. Yeah.
So, everybody, all of, you know, it kind of was in that jazz community. The guys that took that, you know, almost all the guys in the jazz community did that.
I do it, man. I mean,
you know,
I
kind of went there, and I think everybody else that wanted, you know, the song was. It was just about simple.
It was simple.
And just nobody would think that those little notes or those least amount of notes made that stuff happen.
It really
does.
You know
so,
what?
So they just wanted to play more, you know?
And that's the beautiful thing about that stuff. I remember Art telling me, man, a long time ago, he said, man, it's not the shit you play. It's what you don't play. That's what makes it funky.
Yeah.
And that is
well,
true.
Well, that's what 2 Cent used to tell us all the time, man. You know, it's not what you play. It's what you don't play, you know?
Yep.
That makes that space, you know? And I still use that motto, you know? I still use it. It's a part of my fiber now, you know?
You know, one of the other signature bass things, a lot of the stuff that was a big influence on me was, you know, the stuff you and Leo did together, the unison stuff. Like Sissy Strut, where you at? Yeah. What is that? Something like that. You know, that stuff is so funky, man. You could just hear that all day long, and it's... You know, that was great. And what are some other ones, man? Change Reform. I should have practiced it before I sat here. But I didn't know we were going to sit here today. Yeah.
So... record is 6 times, but live we haven't played 6 times ever. Yeah.
Different, man.
Yeah.
Or another one that I'll attempt to bastardize real quick, but has the great bass line, Just Kiss My Baby.
Oh,
that's like the baddest shit ever, and it's so simple.
Yeah, and that's like empty there.
No wah. Yeah.
The bass line couldn't get no simpler than that.
That's all it needs, man. It's so badass just with that, you know. Do do do. Yeah.
Chris Severn used to always say, "Man, see that's like the least amount of notes to make it all make sense."
that's an art to be able to do that, man. Is like that's like a Zen thing to make, you know, make the shit groove huge with hardly any, not even hardly saying anything.
Yeah.
That shows how strong everything was. You know, it's like Zig came backstage at this Hall & Oates concert and he was looking at the drummer and the bass player and he looked at him. He goes, "Man, you see you and you?" And he put his hands like this. He goes, "That's concrete."
Yeah.
And that was like a huge, I told those guys, man, for Zig to say that, the way everything locked together, that's what made, you know, all those parts work, to me anyway. What's your favorite bass line of all the classic meter stuff, or any meter stuff? I mean,
I don't know, man. You know, Africa probably has one of the most grooviest pockets ever. You know, and again, like bass lines that don't say a whole lot. It's just, you know, just a pocket. Well, it is F.
C, right?
Can't get no simpler.
That's bad. And you add Zig in there, and it's huge.
My bass line and the drums, bass drum was just locking. No tighter than that.
And the end of that, you know, those things you do, it's like where you go.
Oh, yeah.
There's one. Yeah. Yeah, man. I love, you know, we were talking earlier, but just in case I didn't get some of your audio, the unison lines that you and Leo did together, like, I mean, just off the top of my head. You know, yeah. So like that. Like, can we play that together?
Okay.
Three, four.
Yeah, so I'm a little sloppy with it. That.
And then the way you turn it around.
Yeah.
Then it goes to E.
Right.
That's a great man.
Better legs, three, four.
That's an iconic frigging line right there, man. Are you using, that bass you're playing is a Lakeland?
Yeah, it's a Lakeland bass. It was modeled after my original P bass that was, you know, came to life in 1970.
That's an exact replica, right?
The neck is an exact replica of that bass, yeah.
What about, that's your famous P bass. I mean, you retired it now, but.
Yeah, it stays home. It's still playable.
Yeah.
But, I wouldn't bring it out into like a session or nothing because it's got some fret buzz, especially when you get above, when you get back here and it's back past the E section of the bass.
But you've been playing that bass for, that Lakeland bass for a while now. Cause I've seen
three and a half years.
It seems like more because I've been on a few sessions with you with that bass.
Yeah.
It looks like you've had it like 15 years.
The neck on this one now is more wore down than the P neck because I put 3.5 years on this neck where the P bass has been sitting at home.
It already looks relict. It looks
so. Yeah, it's aged.
So George, if I for like drummers or something listening, what do you you played with Zig, but you played with a lot of great drummers, man. Besides Zig, what do you look for in a drummer? Because down here in New Orleans, where we are right now, it's a town full of great drummers. But what do you look for when you call somebody? What makes a great drummer that you like to play with?
Well, outside the fact of that, just being able to, time is essence. What makes a great drummer is that he has great timing, and that no matter what he says in his fills, he always know where one is.
Yeah.
So that means that the drummer has to be on top of his game. And that's something that I look for. Yeah, it's the most important. I think the most important thing when you're looking at drummers is the first of all know, their abilities to keep time,
right,
and always know where one is, because it's important that no matter how many they got a bunch of really great drummers out there. They got chops and everything.
Sure.
But they'll make fills and change the tempo, or move it, because, they just made one of these great drum fills, really great drum fills, but he moved the tempo, and that's important I think that's important for me. I mean, that's the first thing I look at is how well he can sit on the time, a lot of guys, and exactly music itself, the drummer is the guardian of the groove. He has to be the guy that holds the pocket down. He has to be the one that keeps us from rushing because as whenever we playing these licks, we can move time, we can move the time, and it's not necessarily that we want to do it, but we do it. And so it's important that the drummer has control of that. He knows that, all right, I got y'all, here, listen to me, and that's important, yeah.
One thing I never knew, who were some of your early influences on bass?
Well, my early influences on bass was a young man named Benjamin Francis. We called him Papi. I think it's that by proxy, it was George French because Papi thought George French was God. He thought, because Papi comes, he listened to all those early recordings, those Earl King recordings from things, and that's the stuff he grew up on. And that's George French playing all that stuff,
Did George French play on Hook and Sling? Who played bass on Hook and Sling? I never figured that out.
I'm not quite sure who's the bass player on that. A lot of people asked if it was me, but that wasn't me, no. And that wasn't Zig either, that's James Black on drum.
Sure.
Yeah.
I figured I was a little before your era, but Well, when was Hook and Sling? 67,
68? 67, 68.
All right,
yeah.
You could have done it for sure, yeah. The Meters had already had...
We were out there.
Yeah,
we were out there, but we wasn't home as much then.
Yeah.
You know, in the late 68, 69, 70, man, they had us jumping from one end of the East Coast. We were mostly running between New Orleans and all the way up as high as Boston, you know, and stuff, you know. I mean, we were stand. I left home at one point in 68, and when I came home, my daughter was a year older.
Wow. Oh, man. You know, I think I'd heard that Paul McCartney had been quoted as saying you were his favorite bass player. And didn't you guys play on the Queen Mary for his, what was it?
We
it
played
was,
for his birthday party.
Birthday.
It was kind of birthday party record release. They actually hadn't released the record yet, but it was like a celebration of the Venus and Mars recording being done. And it was the original Meters. I think Professor Longhair also performed. And it was like the who's of Hollywood was there. You know, everybody from their grandma, you know, everywhere from the Jackson 5 to Paul, what was his name? The little bitty guy, man. Not Paul Simon. He's smaller than Paul Simon.
Oh, he Paul did that. Williams.
Paul Williams.
Yeah. You know, one thing that I think is cool about your playing is that a lot of people don't realize how versatile, you know, of a player you are. I mean, to me, you are. And, you know, we've done stuff together with Dave Torgnowski or whatever where, you know, it's kind of way outside of all of our elements. And then Torg be like, no, George, just solo over it. You know, like some hard chord changes. Like, what was that tune? You know, Monkey Puzzle or some shit
Monkey
like that.
Puzzle, Jay, yeah.
But, I mean, those are hard changes.
Yeah,
man.
Yeah.
And then listen to you play
David,
over it. It's
David
really cool.
David used to tax me. He always tell people, he said, he introduced me to the audience and he'll say, he's the most fearless bass player ever. music to me, I just, when I started playing and when I got, by the time I got off my front porch and decided I was going to go out into the world and discover music, you know, in the early 60s, like 64, 65, 63, 64, man, you know, you had to know more than just R&B.
Yeah.
You know, you had to know how to swing.
Yep.
You had to know how to play a real hard shuffle, you know. And you had to touch on bebop, you know, and my first gig I thought where I learned how to play bebop and swing stuff was with Walter Washington. He was playing with a saxophonist named Frank Moulton, and was playing at a club called the 808. I think I was 15 years old. And but I was tall. I had a process, and I wore dark sunglasses. and the door person just never really cared enough to find out how old I was. And I had a, and I was just kind of easing in the club, you know, because I was trying to see a girl down the street, but never could catch up with her. So I would just kind of sneak in the club, figuring that she's in the club somewhere, you know.
Yeah.
But I heard Walter and them playing. And the band was cooking, but the bass player was like, he was lazy, man. He was a lazy player, man. He played with one hand, a cigarette, and a drink in his right hand. So he had a cigarette stuck between his little finger and the next finger. And then he had the drink. And you know, he would take a sip and a drink, and he'd be...
Wow.
No, and he had that one-handed thing really well because he was walking bass lines with that one hand, but he never got, you know, it wasn't little things that, you know, the little passing ditties that he could have been saying. You know, I just called it was lazy, you know.
Yeah.
If you had two hands on the instrument, you could be saying, you know, more. And at that time in my life, I was a busy player, so I thought more notes. You know, I thought that
well,
more
kind
notes
of the way
could
the
be
bass
sand.
Was designed to play with huh? two hands.
Oh, yeah, oh, yeah.
But, you know, he had to drink and smoke, and, I guess, with the other hand.
So, and I won't call the cats now, but he was a good player. But he, you know, to do what he did with one hand was, you know, me put him in the neighborhood of being a good player. You know, but I sat in one night with those guys, you know, and man, I just, you know, I mean, I was just, I basically, I took the gig,
yeah, yeah,
you know, and that's how I got, and the songs that we were playing, I didn't know songs by names, but those songs, cause they were playing a lot of swing stuff and bebop. By the time they got to the second hour of the gig, they had started playing a little R&B and stuff, which the stuff where I had come in through, you know, earlier, you know, playing with Herbert Wing and Papi and those guys. I knew all that Earl King stuff, and, you know, the Frankie Ford and, Tommy Ridgely. I knew all those songs because we were playing those songs in the frat houses, you know. But you know, and then after the break, the next hour, the last hour of the gig, because those days it was a 4-hour gig. You played the first set was 2.5 hours long. You took a half hour break and come back and you play an hour and then you go home. Well, that last hour, we'd be playing anything from Fats Domino to, you know, some real junkyard blues, you know, and mm-hmm. stuff like that. So, you know, in a 3.5 hour gig, you know, I played a serious amount of music and covered a lot of territory. You know, and doing that for a few, you know, it might have been 4 or 5 months before they found out how old I was.
But by then, you knew all their
you know,
stuff.
I knew a whole lot of music by then.
Yeah, man.
You know, and you know, so I got, you know, at that point, I got thrown out the club because I said, you can't come back in there. You ain't old enough to be in there.
So, you know, that makes me think of what was the place that the Meters were the house band on Louisiana Avenue? Right?
Oh, the Nightcap.
Nightcap. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Is that where Toussaint found all
Well, that's when Toussaint started watching us. He saw, you know, we would the owners would always tell us that, you know, Alan, we were playing there like 4 nights a week. Uh-huh. And we used to do one of those nights, I want to say it was the Thursday night or the Sunday night, we did a talent show at, you know, we'd do talent shows, then people would come in, all kind of wow. weird things. There was a girl that came in, man, and she's a wonderful bass player, but she came in and played tuba one night because it was a talent show, you win money. She would come there on different every other week or something like that and play a different instrument and clean up. she had made a wow. gig out of that, you know, coming there every week. You know, she really was a good player, you know. And that was the Nightcap is where Alan first spotted us, you know. But Alan knew Leo because Leo had worked with Alan earlier. I think Leo might have played on some of that really first Lee Dorsey stuff that Walter Payton is playing bass on,
Coal Mine and all that, or even
Coal Mine and some of that stuff. Kind of things. Yeah.
Wow, that's interesting.
And Art Neville, of course, because Alan had wrote songs for Art. You know.
Sure. Yeah, man. Who's some of your favorite guitar players that you like worked with? I mean, you work with a bunch of great guitar players, too.
You know, I don't know if I have a favorite, per se, you know, because, you know, there's a bunch of really, really wonderful players that I've played with over my thing. I really loved Low George. You know, Low was a wonderful player, wonderful player. I mean, Leo would probably be my favorite guitar player, you know, of mostly all time, just because of, you know, his approach to playing, you know, back in the 60s, you know. His thoughts have changed now from the way, you know, he was one of the greatest rhythm guitar players on the planet.
I agree.
He doesn't play quite that way anymore, but when he sticks to playing rhythm, he can't be touched because of some of the stuff that he plays and his feel, you know, it's just remarkable, you know.
Yeah.
And for me, guitar players that have that thing, that rhythm thing, It's the thing that I love. You know, Lowell had that rhythm thing, you know.
Yeah.
And then on top of this, it's a slide thing. You know, when I first heard Brent Anderson, you know, I was overlooking the rhythm thing because he played slide. And that just blew me away. You know, yeah. I said, wow. You know, I took Brent into the band with Running Partners. I said,
yeah.
You know, Brent's been in the band for 25 years almost, you know.
Yeah, he's a great player, man. There was a couple other ones. You know, I can't remember. They'll all come to me after. Yeah, you know, when I first got in the Nevilles, man, I was exposed to, I didn't really, I guess I kind of grew up listening. My mom had a couple of Meters records.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember, of course, everybody had They All Asked for You, you know, that 45.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I remember my mom had that 45. And I remember listening to that record. The flip side was Running Fast.
Running Fast. Oh, wow.
And, man, I remember that. Like, that hit me. And, you know, the thing we were doing today, that track we were doing today, I told you during the playback in the control room, I said, man, that's like a, I don't know how Running Fast, I forget it. But I remember the lick was that little thing. I forget how Running Fast goes, but I don't remember. Yeah, I don't remember how it goes, but.
But no, it's out of the way. It's 3-4. Oh, yeah, it's. Running Fast. Yeah, you're playing it. You got the lick, but
yeah,
it's backwards. You're playing
it
backwards.
I never learned the lick, but I just, that little move I got from something.
Donnie Young, it's the Donnie Young. You can't hide from me. That's real close.
Something like that.
I don't think nobody plays that. We never played it.
Yeah.
We never ever played that song.
I remember Change Reform, or you know, we used to do that with the Nevilles every once in a while. I'd beg Art to do it, man. Every once in a while we'd do it. Let's see. You were on Wild Chapatulas, right?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That was sort of the beginning of. Well, that was sort of the merging of Neville Brothers and Meters, almost, right?
Well, that was the thing that Art was, you know. See, Art, you know, the Meters had been doing the thing, and before Art's mom passed away, she told Art that she wanted him to unite the brothers, you know, mm-hmm. put all his brothers in one spot. You know, she wanted him to be the leader of the family, you know, to take over the family. And so he had that buried in the back of his head, is that the best way to get all these people is in one place is to have a band that they all could contribute to. Well, the Meters was that band, you know, but the problem was is that the three of us, the other three remaining Meters, then, you know, if we would have gave up, we would have lost being our identity as the Meters if we'd have had all of those brothers because A, they were singers, you know, and they would have not been the same, you know, because our musical background and influence where we'd have been now playing to singers or for singers. Now that, you know, and we never really know, because it could have been, you know, we could have had hits if we'd
have
had
been
singers.
Like Earth, Wind, and Fire.
Yeah, you know, but
I think you did pretty good.
So, but that's, yeah, we the band fought that, and eventually the band lost Art and Cyril, and so because of the three of us, you know, fighting against that.
Well, what about your solo records, man? You got a bunch of solo records out.
Yeah, I think I've done seven.
Running Partners.
I didn't really realize that till the other day that I've done five Running Partners records and two George Porter records. And I've seen, you know, as a songwriter, I've seen myself kind of growing, you know, mm-hmm. And I'm, you know, the last recording I did, was, you know, it was like an EP. It wasn't a whole album, but mm-hmm. it was like songs that I wrote the music, and then I went and found singers to collaborate lyrics with me. You know, Anders Osborne on, mm-hmm. on one, you know, Tony Hall and Denise Sullivan on, mm-hmm. On one. I think what was the third one? Oh, Johnny Vodakovich.
Wow, I got to hear that, man.
Yeah, the song that Johnny did was one he does all the time, Be Careful Who You Idolize, with his solo thing. But, you know, but he plays it totally different. You know, I added chord changes to it and a totally different pocket. But it was like, and then I wrote a second verse for it because I kept, Johnny said, oh, I got another verse. And I kept on calling Johnny, the song's almost done. I need a verse, you know. So he never gave me the other verse. So I just wrote a verse, you know.
And what's the name of that tune?
That one's called Be Careful Who You Idolize.
Oh, yeah, yeah, I've heard that.
Yeah, oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, Johnny's been singing that for 30 years.
Yeah, yeah. Use caution when you pick your guru. Look aside. For that true you. Be careful who you idolize. Use caution when you pick your guru. Don't pray. Yeah, man.
You know, it's one of his poems.
Yeah, like Dr. Watson and eating spaghetti and all that. Yeah, you know, also, a lot of people don't realize the sideman stuff you've done, like a couple Tori Amos records. And
yeah, I mean, the three Tori Amos records.
Yeah, Government Mule.
We have one Government Mule record. Well, two. I was on two.
But you were one, in the band one was for the,
one,
a little
the,
while.
One was the album, and then we did the live one, you know, where I did pieces. You know, it was like the first album was just one song. It was me and Art. On the up, I think it was called The Deepest End, and then I was on maybe 30 minutes of Up from the Deepest End, which was the live at the Sanger Theater.
You have any bass, any favorite moments that have been recorded that you're the most proud of, out of anything that you've done?
Bass moments?
Yeah, just stuff that you're really
know.
Proud
you know,
of.
I when I sit back and think about, well, you know, when I'm writing. And I do the track. I don't have the lyrics in mind. You know, I know that their lyrics may be coming. So I wind up putting a bass track down, and eventually I have to go back and change the bass line because I can't sing it and play it at the same time, you know? So eventually I have to go back and redo the bass lines. But, you know, there was a great bass line before I put the vocals on, but now it's a smaller bass line because, you know, it's just... You know, I have to make space for the vocals.
Well, how about just out of, you know, just something that survived that process that you're the most proud of that you think is a, you know.
Ooh, oh, man.
I mean, anything.
Okay, well, you know what I did this one for, this is on the records. It's Anderson, I wrote this one, but it's called Talking About My Old Friends. And this one of the... Thank you.
That's cool.
Then eventually, I put it on it, and then eventually assigned it to a guitar, yeah, to Brent, and let him play that.
Yeah, man. How would you play, like when you play a shuffle, what do you think about?
Shuffle. You see, my shuffle is just, and it's a one note thing.
You know, I guess I'm playing the Chicago thing over the top.
Well, yeah, but, you know, because that's what it was. That's the Chicago shuffle.
I guess that's what it's called, right? I never knew, but.
And also the Texas shuffle was.
Oh. Wow, that's cool. I never knew that.
You know, that's the way, we was talk, because the drummers used to be.
Ah.
So it would be boom, da, boom, da, boom, and everything would play that. Boom, da, boom, da, boom, da, ba, where the New Orleans drummers would play shuffle that.
I see, yeah.
And everything played that. The snare, the kick drum, and us ride cymbal would be playing.
Everything together, yeah.
And then there was a guy out here named Buddy Williams, which was one of the best shuffle drummers I ever know. But Buddy used to play, man, he would put the backbeat on a kick drum. Boom, 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 boom.
Ah.
That was a very strong shuffle, man. You know,
man, that sounds like it. Just that right there sounds strong.
Yeah, I think the wife will be looking for dinner
okay.
in a little bit.
But look, George, thank you so much, man, for hanging and doing this.
Oh, man, thank you, Sam, for inviting me, bro.
Yeah,
you
man, know? It's always great to play with you. Hopefully it's not a year again before we do something. I'll send you a copy of this when it's done.
All right. Let me know. Give me, when you post it, or you send me a link.
I will. Well, there you have it. Thank you, George, for hanging out, talking to me a little bit. Thank you for listening to this episode of Riff Raff. The music you're listening to right now is a tune called In the Cracks. It's a tune of mine from a record that I produced with a great drummer named Doug Belote from New Orleans, featuring George Porter on bass. So if you like it, check that out. If you like this podcast, let me know. Visit me on ShaneTerrio.com or ShaneTerrio.music on Facebook. Thank you again to True Fire for helping me push this. And see you next time.
Without the ones like you, who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you, with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.